Welcome to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. My co-host Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, though he stands little chance of being convicted and removed from office by the U.S. Senate, Donald Trump this week became only the third U.S. president to be impeached. In a historic Wednesday vote, the U.S. House of Representatives passed two impeachment articles related to Trump's conduct with Ukraine. Republicans in the House who hail from Florida were vocal in their opposition to the vote. Let's listen now to Congressmen John Rutherford, Matt Gaetz, and Gus Bilirakis.
Somewhere in Russia right now, Putin is laughing at us today. The majority has given him exactly what he wants. A divided America with a pure partisan politics.
Democrats may have won the House in 2018, but they haven't forgiven Donald Trump for having the audacity to win the presidency. And they haven't forgiven you, the American people, for voting for him.
This whole process has been a ploy to circumvent the will of the people by removing a duly elected president of the United States. It is a national disgrace and sets a dangerous precedent.
Now, Democrats, of course, disagree. Representative Donna Shalala joins us now. The Miami Democrats supported impeachment, she says, to ensure the legacy of the Constitution. Representative Shalala, thanks for appearing here on the Florida Roundup.
You're welcome.
Could I first get your reaction to your Republican colleagues here in Florida that we just listened to on impeaching the president? What they said, that this is setting a dangerous precedent for America.
Oh, absolutely not. What is setting a dangerous precedent is a president who has ignored the Constitution, who thinks he can do anything he wants to do. And he has not only obstructed justice by trying to stop the Congress from getting the facts, he has used a foreign country, taxpayers' money, to try to interfere with the elections in 2020. That is high crimes and misdemeanor. He has clearly violated the Constitution, and that's why the impeachment process took effect. And let me say that I'm just shocked that not one Republican stood up, saw the facts, and came to a very different conclusion. Our conclusion was that the president has put national security at risk. He has interfered, asked a foreign country to interfere in our elections, and he has obstructed justice by telling his staff that they could not honor subpoenas and come before the Congress and to testify towards the facts. But the facts were brought up by courageous public servants. We heard the facts, and we made the judgment that the president had committed high crimes and misdemeanors and that he ought to be impeached.
Now, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she's considering not sending the articles of impeachment over to the Senate unless she's convinced there will be a fair trial there. Critics are calling that a stall tactic. What's your response to their criticism of this potential move?
Well, she's waiting to see what the process is going to be. The speaker needs to appoint managers. In other words, the prosecutors. We have the facts. We take them over to the Senate, including our conclusion of impeachment. And but we don't know. The majority leader has not said how the trial will be conducted. So I think it's perfectly appropriate for her to wait and find out whether there will, in fact, be a fair trial and how it's going to be organized. The majority leader has already said that he's coordinating with the White House. He's the foreman of the jury. Already he's come to a conclusion about the facts without hearing the case. So it's very distasteful. I think the speaker is doing exactly the right thing, and that is she's waiting to see how the Senate is going to organize itself for a fair trial.
Let me ask you one more follow-up. You were part of the Clinton administration, as many know. You experienced impeachment when you were part of that White House, the last time a president was impeached. President Clinton was impeached by the House, but not convicted by the Senate. Those opposed to impeachment have argued, given that precedent, what is the point of impeaching Donald Trump if he's not going to be removed? What's your response as someone who went through this with another president?
Well, first of all, it's painful whether it's President Clinton or whether it's President Trump. I don't do this with any joy. It is our solemn duty to uphold our oath of office, and that's precisely what we did in the House. It was improper for us to look ahead to the Senate as opposed to doing our duty. We swore to uphold the Constitution. That is precisely what the impeachment vote was.
If you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup as we speak with Congresswoman Donna Shalala. And the number to join us is 305-995-1800. Tweets to @FloridaRoundup. Of course, impeachment was a huge story this week. But right now, we'd like to shift gears and touch on another story that involves the White House. It's the move by the USDA, the United States Department of Agriculture. They've proposed a new rule that would essentially end SNAP benefits. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program for more than 300,000 Floridians, including almost 200,000 kids. Now, these cuts are designed to prevent what the Trump administration calls work-eligible people from receiving benefits. As we continue with Representative Shalala, we're also welcoming to the program Katie DeBriere, legal director and staff attorney with the Florida Health Justice Project. Katie, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And what's your reaction to news that the U.S. Department of Agriculture might cut SNAP benefits for more than 300,000 Floridians? Call us up here on the Florida Roundup at 305-995-1800. Katie, how will the SNAP cuts affect people in this state?
Sure, Melissa. And if I might start by just giving some context to the there's three proposed rules currently. Two proposed rules and one final adopted rule currently pending with the United States, with USDA. The first rule, two of the rules are ones that we will not feel as deep an impact in Florida, but nationwide are going to have devastating consequences. One of those rules is related to what we refer to as ABODs, or able-bodied dependents without children. USDA has currently proposed and, in fact, adopted, it will be implemented in April of 2020, which restricts states' ability to grant waivers for what is a requirement that individuals be participating in 80 hours of work per month, or else they can only receive food assistance for 3 months in a 3-year period. Mm-hmm. In Florida in particular, the Florida legislature actually beat USDA to the punch on this issue. And effective January 1st of 2016, the Florida legislature required that the Department of Children and Families, who oversees these waivers with USDA, ask permission first of the Florida legislature before granting any waiver. So effective January 1st, 2016, ABOD is the rule of Florida. And had at the time devastating impact on individuals receiving SNAP benefits. Over 500,000 individuals were kicked off those benefits when Florida legislature moved to make that decision a couple years ago. But because of that, we won't have the same kind of impact that will occur across the country for those states that are still choosing to opt into the waiver.
Still, though, Congresswoman Shalala, hundreds of thousands of Floridians could be affected. This also, it's my understanding, affects kids on free and reduced lunch. Are you hearing about this from your constituents?
I am. 70%, at least 70% of the kids in Miami-Dade County receive free lunches, and this is really devastating. SNAP is an anti-hunger program, and it impacts the neediest people in our community. I can't think of anything worse during the holidays than the government being absolute Scrooges and sending a message to our poorest families that their children will be cut off of school lunch programs, and that others will lose their food benefits. This is the most fundamental kind of program that we have, as Americans, provide. And you know, at the simplest, it's really micromanaging the states. The states have been managing this program. The Trump administration has decided that they're not they've been too generous to the most vulnerable people in the states, and therefore they're tightening the screws on the program. And frankly, I would trust the states a little bit more, and I'm surprised that Republicans would try to micromanage state decisions about the most vulnerable people in their community.
Katie, what options will people have here in Florida if they can no longer use their SNAP or EBT card to buy groceries?
I think we're going to see increased pressure on food banks in order to meet that coverage that over 98,000 families are going to lose SNAP benefits under another proposed rule, categorical elimination of categorical eligibility, which is going to greatly tamp down who is financially eligible for SNAP benefits. We're looking at 200,000 children in the state of Florida losing those SNAP benefits. And there's no doubt in my mind those children will need to get the food from somewhere. So we're going to see increased pressure on food banks and other nonprofits who fill the gap that's already there between SNAP assistance and family income to feed their families.
And it's the Florida Roundup as we talk about cuts to, you think of it as the nation's food stamp program, although people don't use a booklet of food stamps anymore when they use these benefits. It's the SNAP program. What are your questions and comments about this? It's 305-995-1800. Give us a call. William is in Orlando. Hey, William, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to make two comments. One, just so people realize, these are working poor people. They have jobs, 99% of them, the parents. And they're working at Walmart that underpays their workers. You know, Dollar Tree stores. You can name all these stores that are making $10 an hour or less, a minimum wage. And they just can't afford food. You know, they can barely afford a place to live. I mean, it's horrific. So the economy is booming, but 50% of the jobs are these low-wage jobs. So that's one thing. And the second thing is Trump cut the corporate tax $1 trillion worth of tax revenue for the government to actually afford these programs went out the window because of Trump. And corporations love it, but people are suffering. So I just think that the attitude of the Trump people is cruel. It's cruel and unusual punishment.
William, thanks for the call. Representative Shalala.
I think the caller is exactly right. And, you know, one of the things that we have to think about, it, the airport workers that I've been working with here in Miami-Dade County, many of them are on food stamps. You just don't cut off your most vulnerable population. And as the caller said, the vast majority of them are working.
Katie, that's the big misconception about this program, isn't it? That people are freeloading, getting food off the taxpayer's dime. Can you give us some more statistics about who in Florida and the nation uses SNAP, uses the program?
Yeah, I would also agree with the caller that this is going to have a heavy impact on working low-income working families with the CAT elimination of the categorical eligibility. We're seeing what was a gross income test of 200% of the federal poverty limit drop down to 133%, and also very importantly, implementation of asset rules. So in that instance, you're looking at working families who are experiencing, you know, just a minor loss of income, for example, but who have a nest egg to carry them through one minor emergency, a broken down car or, a rent payment. If they implement the asset rules, then those individuals will be thrown off SNAP. I think another population that isn't talked about as much as the children and working families is also seniors. Those seniors also retain small nest eggs to either pass down to their children or, more importantly, make it from one emergency to another, loss of coverage of health insurance for a month, for example. Small amount of money in the bank is going to allow them to cover those needed medical costs. But under the new SNAP rule, those individuals would not be able to retain that small nest egg to get them from one month to another.
Let's go to Dory in Delray Beach. Dory, thanks for calling the Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts about SNAP?
Well, I'm not trying to play the devil's advocate here, and I certainly want food to go to needy people. But just a comment, I was a high school teacher in Miami-Dade County for 22 years, and the last 15 of them were in the same school in Southwest Miami. And I had kids that would come in at the beginning of the year, and they would fill out the applications for the free and reduced lunches. And I met a lot of the parents during the open house and so on, and I would say to the kids, your parents can't afford to buy you lunch or give you lunch money, and they would say, oh, yeah, they can. They just want to take advantage of this program. And that happened often over the course of 10, 15 years. And I thought, well, a lot of the people that really need the food may not get it in the future because the program is being strained by people that really don't need it. But just because it's available, they do take advantage of it.
All right, Dory. Yeah, thank you for that. Donna Shalala, what about some voters out there who think people are taking advantage of this program?
Well, there has not been widespread fraud in the program, and many communities have decided that everybody should get to remove the stigma of free or reduced lunches, that they want all the kids to get it so that no kid feels ashamed because their family can't afford it. But I've seen very little fraud in the system, and we shouldn't, even if there is some fraud in the system, that's no reason to reduce eligibility. Florida has had for a long time covered people 200% of poverty. We're one of the more generous states because we care about vulnerable working folks. And, there are a lot of rumors out there about fraud, but when the investigators have gone in, they found very little.
Katie.
Yeah, I would just add to that, of course, two things. One is that it's not as though these individuals, once they make an application for food stamps, automatically qualify. They have to go through both a 200% of the federal poverty limit gross income test. So we're looking at that alone as a very low number. It's just referring to my notes.
It's okay.
It's a very low number.
It's a low number.
It's slightly less than $1,200 a month. And then you are, for a family of four, and then you are looking at, on top of that, a net income test. So that is just one part of the analysis of SNAP eligibility. And then you're looking at a net income test of 100% of the federal poverty limit. So we are talking about very low income individuals. And those individuals then the children automatically qualify for free or reduced lunch. So that does not encapsulate the entire population of children.
Of children
who
could be affected. Lots
exactly.
of people waiting on hold to talk about this. Is the government being a Grinch? Or do you agree with the cuts to the SNAP program for low-income people in Florida and the nation? It's 305-995-1800. Tweets to at Florida Roundup. As we continue the conversation in just a moment here, give us a call. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross. And as we continue talking about the Trump administration's proposed cuts to SNAP, what many still think of as the nation's food stamp program, we're getting lots of calls and tweets about this. You can tweet us at Florida Roundup. Here's a tweet from Sharon. Remember, the minimum wage hike to $15 an hour will be on the 2020 ballot in Florida. That will pull people out to vote, and it will benefit candidates who are more supportive of the working poor and the middle class. What do you think? It's 305-995-1800. Nicole is on the line from Panama City. Hi, Nicole. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hi. So I'm calling because I think that a lot of people listening are thinking of food stamps as, you know, just a handout, and it doesn't really help people up out of poverty. And while I would agree that it's not a perfect system, it has helped at least me and my family out of poverty. My husband and our three children have been working poor for two generations now. And we were able to pull ourselves out of poverty having food stamps where we didn't have to worry about that bill of the food and how we were going to feed our children. And we were on food stamps for about 7 years, and now I'm in graduate school at a prominent university completing a master's degree. So I would say that they really do help people and make a difference in their lives.
All right, Nicole, thanks for sharing your story. Congresswoman Shalala, certainly that's the intent of the program.
The intent of the program is to make sure that people don't go hungry in our country, but just as important, it supports them as they work and lift themselves out of poverty. That's a great example. And most people, we want more and more people to use these support systems as a transition. But for some families, they'll have it for a lifetime because they work the very, very minimum wage, and that minimum wage does not cover their needs. And we just don't want anyone in this country to go hungry.
Now, Katie DeBriere, here's another point of view from a listener tweeting the show. Other than fraud, is there not a valid argument to reduce SNAP benefits as an incentive to get people to work during a period with full employment and a booming economy? That's certainly the argument the White House is making.
Sure. So I would just circle back around to the earlier point we were making that as of January 1st, 2016, the state of Florida has already adopted work requirements and time limits on individuals receiving SNAP assistance under the same theory that those work requirements will encourage people to go out into the workforce. What we saw instead, unfortunately, is the loss of over 500,000 people on benefits. These are people with hidden disabilities who are unable to report to the Department of Children and Families that they're unable to work. It also disproportionately impacts people of color and those individuals with GEDs or high school diplomas who have a much more difficult time finding employment, even in a even in an economy that is stronger than we've seen in past years.
305-995-1800. James is in West Palm Beach. Hi, James. Thanks for calling. You're on the radio. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I was just kind of wondering what kind of limits there are on what people can use the cards to buy, because I've seen people buying junk food or sodas or even some fast food restaurants accepting the food stamp card as payment.
Sure. Okay, let's explain what the EBT or SNAP card, how it can be used, Katie. It's my understanding you can't use it to buy just anything. Can you explain the limitations and the rules?
Sure. It has to be used to purchase food. So you can't buy other household necessities with SNAP benefits. Additionally, you can't buy pre-prepared or hot food with SNAP benefits. They have to be, you know, your traditional food items from the grocery store that you're going to be using to prepare meals. I have heard this common argument that, you know, we should further limit how individuals spend their money on particular food like junk food or soda. I think we need to remember that those are, one, individual choices that our families are making within the budget that they have within their month to pay for food. And then, two, I would push back a little bit on making those judgments in as much as I'm not sure how you identify who's using SNAP benefits versus just a regular EBT card, because they do look precisely the same.
Congresswoman Shalala, the whole point of getting rid of food stamps was to reduce stigma so that people, when they go through the grocery line, they just look like any other grocery shopper. Something else that has
isn't that right?
Something else that's come to my attention, too, is the benefit is small enough that a lot of folks on it can't afford to buy healthy produce. They tend to buy in bulk things like pasta or other big box foods that are processed and not as healthy because that's what they can afford. So in that sense, the program is contributing to obesity and poor health if you can't afford to buy produce on this program, correct?
Well, and we have food deserts in low-income neighborhoods. In other words, access to affordable, healthy food is a real problem in many of the low-income neighborhoods in our communities. I also would point out that the economy works differently in different parts of our state as well as in different parts of the country. So a booming economy is not necessarily everywhere, and we've got to be very careful. In Miami-Dade County, we simply have thousands of people who are working but have very low wages, and they desperately need the food, the opportunity for SNAP benefits.
In that group, Congresswoman, how many, I know this, it's not hard to do an estimate, how many working poor Floridians, do we have a number of how many would be thrown off the program, people who are working but still need this benefit to make ends meet?
Katie may have that. We know that nearly 200,000 children could lose their automatic access to school lunches. Katie, do you have a number on the number of adults?
So in total, we're looking at 328,000 Floridians. Of those is 90,000 families. So I think it's safe to assume a large chunk of those 90,000 families are going to be low-income workers supporting children and other dependents in their household.
And lots of calls. Let's go to a few more of you coming in from all over Florida. Glenn is in Hilliard. Hey, Glenn, thanks for calling the Florida Roundup.
Hello.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, my mother-in-law is 80 years old, and she's on Social Security and SNAP program as well. And they recently cut her benefits, her SNAP benefits, from $158 a month to $17 a month.
Wow.
And
so
I don't know where to go from there.
And so what are you, what's your family doing to try to get her? Are you just taking food to her yourself? What
we're buying her groceries. I had to pay her light bill like 2 days ago, and I just don't understand this. Why are we doing this to our country?
Glenn, thanks for the call, and I'm so sorry that your family's going through that. Okay, Katie, he's talking about his 80-year-old mother-in-law, who, let's not forget senior citizens
exactly.
as well, who are dependent on
this program. Yeah, she's probably on minimum
program.
Social Security, too.
Say that again, Congresswoman?
She's probably on minimum Social Security.
Okay, so then for a lot of seniors,
While they've cut back on our benefits.
So seniors are dependent on a Social Security check and a SNAP benefit who are on a really small fixed income, like his mother-in-law, it sounds like. And so this will impact them.
And Medicaid, them. To supplement Medicare.
Sure. Okay, let's go to Fred in Daytona. He's got some thoughts about cuts to SNAP. Hi, Fred.
Hey, thank you for the opportunity to talk.
Sure.
My comment question is that people that have an issue with the SNAP program and providing some assistance to the working poor, because our minimum wage is so low that people have to choose between eating and maybe medicine or buying diapers. And the same people don't seem to have any problem with all the subsidies that people like farmers get from the government, all the subsidies that large corporations get and the tax breaks that they get. Probably almost everybody is getting some kind of subsidies from the government in one way or another. But we have a problem when it's the poorest of us that are getting it because they don't have a voice and they can't fight back. But that's just my comment.
Fred,
and the other thing is that for a political party that wraps themselves in the American flag but doesn't uphold the Constitution, and for a party that hides behind the Bible but doesn't want to give benefit to the poorest of the poor, I just have a real problem with that, and I'm kind of ashamed of our country right now.
Fred, thanks for the call. Congresswoman Shalala, let's be clear, you're a Democrat, so you have a point of view on this. That said, you know, when you look at the polling on this, there's bipartisan support for making sure the people who are the most food insecure in America have access to food.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're their voices. We're the voices for the elderly, for working families, for kids. And that's why programs like this are so important, because I do not consider this a partisan issue. I consider it an issue of decency, and that's what Americans are. And the most minimal benefits to make sure that people have enough to eat, that they have decent health care, is what we're about as a country. It says a lot about our character.
And to reinforce the Congresswoman's point, I think, you know, a lot of people should know that in 2018, a lot of these proposals were put forth in the Farm Bill, and Congress, in a bipartisan manner, decided they did not want to adopt any of these cuts to SNAP benefits. So the USDA has independently sought this through administrative rulemaking instead.
Okay. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. As we talk about proposed cuts to the nation's, typically it's been called the food stamp program. The official name is the SNAP program. What are your thoughts? Zita has been holding in Tallahassee. Zita, thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a mental health provider here in Tallahassee, and I'm also a Medicaid provider, and I work with the court systems working with families in dependency. And I think this is just ludicrous and just so cruel that this administration is cutting the SNAP program, and especially the school lunch program. So many children need this. And even if there is fraud, which, you know, I was listening earlier while you all were talking about, you know, the possibility of parents, you know, fraudulently, you know, signing up for the program when they can or might be able to provide, you know, lunch for their children. Even if there is fraud going on, which it sounds like there's not a lot of fraud going on, why punish the children? The children are the ones being punished. If there is fraud, it's the parents who are being fraudulent, not the children. So I don't understand why this administration continues to be so cruel to families who are in need. And all of the clients that I work with who are on Medicaid are all working. They're all trying to make ends meet. They have multiple children, a lot of them. So they depend on sometimes the only time the kids are going to get any kind of a nutritional or good meal is when they're at school. And I think this is the cruelest thing that our government can do. And that's why we need to get Trump out of there. I'm just so disgusted by everything this administration does. And this is just one more thing.
All right, Zita,
thank you for the call.
Regardless of where people stand politically, Congresswoman Shalala, it's my understanding that there might be a lawsuit or multiple lawsuits filed to stop this cut to food benefits for Americans from taking effect. What can we expect over the next several months?
Well, you know, Congress will try to stop it again, and there will be lawsuits. You know, I worked at the Department of Health and Human Services for 8 years in the Clinton administration, and the building is named for Hubert Humphrey. And there's a quote on the wall that I remember, and it went something like this, that the moral test of a government is how we treat the children and seniors and the sick, the needy, and the disabled. and helping to make sure people aren't going hungry, it seems to me that the least we could do to meet that moral test. And you can hear in the voices of the people that are calling in, I just do not believe this is a partisan issue. I don't think it has to do with Republicans or Democrats. We happen to have a Republican administration that is just plain cruel, that has found a way to literally take food out of the mouths of children. And that's just not very American. It's not American at all. It's not who we are as a country.
Well, it's certainly a story we'll continue to follow here on the Florida Roundup. And we really appreciate everyone who called in and tweeted the show. And we want to thank you as well. Congresswoman Donna Shalala on the line from Miami, the Miami Democrat, also worked in the Clinton White House, as many know. So we appreciate your thoughts, Congresswoman, on proposed cuts to SNAP. Thank you for being with us this Friday and have a good holiday.
Thank you.
Also joining us for this segment, Katie DeBriere with the Florida Health Justice Project, working on these issues of poverty and food insecurity in Florida. Katie, thank you so much for joining us. And as you pointed out to us, this isn't over. We're still going to have to follow it and see what happens in the new year.
Absolutely. And thank you for having us and for your attention to the issue.
Yeah, it's a big issue. And sorry we couldn't get to every single call. It's certainly one that is impacting many, many Floridians. But don't go away, because there is so much still to come here on the Florida Roundup. In a moment, we're going to talk about the census. Seems kind of boring, but it actually isn't. Because if there isn't an accurate count of the census in Florida in 2020, that could affect a lot of things in this state, more than you could ever imagine. What are your questions about the census? Get on the line now, 305-995-1800, here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, and thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Tom Hudson is out this week. Well, Florida gets just one official chance each decade to count its population. That's right, mandated by the U.S. Constitution, data collected by the Census Bureau next year will determine the number of seats Florida has in Congress, and it will also be used to distribute federal funds across the state and to local communities. But some organizations are concerned the state might not get an accurate count. They say that means Florida could lose billions of dollars and could be underrepresented in Congress for the next decade. So what's going on exactly with the census? Right now, we welcome Sabine Perwes. She's the CEO of the Florida Nonprofit Alliance. They're part of a coalition of groups that makes up Florida Counts Census 2020. Sabine Perwes, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Melissa.
And it's 305-995-1800. What are your questions about the census count in Florida? Now, Florida Counts is an initiative that is seeking a complete and accurate census count here in the state next year. Why did these groups feel the need to form this effort?
Well, we really started getting alarmed early last year when we saw that there was no state count committee being established, that there was no appropriations being delegated to this cycle for census funding. And a lot of times there's a misconception that the Census Bureau comes in and takes care of everything and leaves and no extra work is needed, and that is not the case. Our sister city states across the borderlines in Alabama and Georgia have been working on the census for years. And so that's where we all stepped up of how can we get behind this effort to ensure that the count is what it should be? Because in the last cycle, we lost close to $20 billion in the 2010 count. And so we don't want to repeat that.
Why did Florida lose $20 billion 10 years ago?
1.4 million people were missed. And so since that period, we have already gained 3 million additional people. So we want to make sure many of that population is just aware that the census is coming. And because the 2020 census is so unique in that it is now going to be online, people just don't know about many of the changes that are coming down. So we want to be extra careful in relaying that information.
Now, the census going online, how big of a factor is that for you and your organization, Florida Counts, in that it may impact how accurately we count every head in the state.
So 17% of Floridians do not have access to reliable internet. So they either have dial-up or no internet access. And so when that happens, then you think about, where do those people live? What do they have access to? Is there a library within walking distance? And the answer is usually no. And so for us, our efforts are really focusing on the hard-to-count population within Florida. These are people that don't have internet access, that are working multiple jobs. Many of the population that you all were discussing around SNAP benefits, that is directly related to the census because that program is funded from this as well.
So it sounds as though this isn't a new issue, though, for Florida. If we undercounted last time, there's a chance we could undercount again this time. But there are differences a decade later. Let's talk about something your organization, Florida Counts, has highlighted. Not only will citizens be asked to complete the census online, there are also fears about even taking the census, answering the census. Why is that?
Well, I think the political realities just make it difficult for a lot of non-native English speakers to think about how and what the purpose of the census is. So last go around in 2010, for example, in Texas, there were certain counties by the Mexican border that they hired Puerto Rican staffers to go and knock on doors and get them to complete it. Their accents were different. People didn't open doors for them. And so if they don't trust the people that are coming, if the people don't reflect the communities in which they are going to knock on doors, that's going to be a problem. And with our low unemployment rate, the census is having difficulty staffing those door knockers. And that's also going to be an issue when it comes to counting those people that don't respond to the internet, don't read their mail, and don't know why the census is important.
Let's go to Anita in Orlando. She's got a question about the census in 2020. Hi, Anita. You're on the Florida Roundup.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My question is this, exactly to the point that she was just talking about with regards to perhaps, you know, unlike suppressing the vote, but suppressing participation. I do live in the Orlando area, and I go down to Kissimmee quite a bit because I work in a home health situation. And it does take a little effort, and I am Hispanic, to win the trust of individuals that, first, you know, English is not their first language. And secondly, they're, you know, a little uncertain about who you are. So if the census, a group is having difficulty attracting people to be able to speak to them, and then there's a distrust, I'm just concerned that, you know, we're going to get a very inaccurate count, and it's going to have a financial impact to be able to help everyone.
Anita, thanks. Sabine.
So that's something that we are deliberately trying to address with Florida Counts. So the part of the reason that we are raising dollars to re-grant out to the state is exactly that. So we've raised close to $800,000 right now that we just re-granted out $300,000 this cycle, and the next right cycle will be in February. And those grants are going into communities to these trusted organizations where we are training their staff members, where we are providing workshops so that these home health workers like Anita are able to talk about the census, are equipped, are familiar, and are telling their constituents and clients repeatedly before March arrives, before that first postcard is mailed.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. The census affects a lot of aspects of your life, whether or not highway expansion gets funded. Agricultural communities can be affected if there's less federal funding for school lunches. There could be less money for medical services. All kinds of things flow from an accurate census count. Let's go to Jason in Jacksonville. Jason, thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you. So I have actually connected with Melissa about this on her local show, First Coast Connect.
Yeah.
I'm wondering how we account for snowbirds. I am a Floridian, and I live here year-round, but I have firsthand knowledge of people in my immediate family who are registered voters here, who have paid their taxes here. But the fact of the matter is they only spend 3 or 4 months a year in Florida. They spend the rest of the time up in their upper Midwest home where they grew up and live and where most of their friends live. Quite frankly, they're not satisfying the residency requirements. And I know I've lived and worked all over Florida, and I'm wagering there's a 500,000 to 1 million people like this. And I would like to see them get scrubbed off these voter rolls if they're not living here. I believe their residency requirement is 7 months. So my question is, how do we account for them? Is there anything being done to do some scrubbing of the voter rolls in Florida so that if those people want to live here, pay their taxes here, and vote here, they actually have to move here and not simply get a condo or a small house, homestead it, and register to vote while living up in, you know, the Ohio's, the Mississippi's, the Missouri's, the Wisconsin's, the Michigan.
All those cold places, Jason, right?
Yeah. All those things.
Yep,
I
okay.
Just don't think it's right.
All right. I hear you, Jason.
Thanks, Melissa.
Okay. All right. I can hear the frustration in his voice, Sabine. What about the snowbirds and how do they factor into the census count?
So the Census Bureau would say the census is where you are at that time when you receive the postcard, because it is only from March through around June, July, depending on when you complete it. So where you are when you receive it is what matters. I will add that, you know, college students that live in dorms, a lot of the Caucasian population, they do tend to get overcounted for maybe some of the reasons that the caller just highlighted. But there are formulas in place to account for that. The bigger problem is that the people that get undercounted, the people that are not factored in at all.
They're not in there at all.
No.
Yeah.
And a lot of those people include children under the age of four. People just forget that their kids need to be counted, newborns, and that. And they are the
population. Count every head.
And they are the population that uses a lot of services
of
over 10 years.
Sure.
Yes.
Let's get in one more call. It's DC in Miami. DC, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I think these two subjects are really extremely connected.
Yes, they are.
Whether it's the census restrictions or the SNAP restrictions. What we're looking at here is an administration, basically, that has an undercurrent, which, you know, we're reluctant to just say for what it is. And that is actions that undercut minorities and non-white. And what I was trying to get through and trying to call under the SNAP discussion with Congresswoman Shalala is, what's the next step? If Trump gets elected, is he going to say, well, there should be work restrictions if a parent wants to have their kid go to free public school? I mean, this train of thought, if you follow it, goes into that track too.
DC,
I
appreciate the call, and I don't mean to cut you off. It's just that we're about to wrap things up. So, Sabine Purways, could you give us your final thoughts about why this is important for Florida?
I think I would say two things. One, if anyone has questions and wants access to resources, toolkits, they should go to flcounts.com. The census touches everything that we do, and it requires local and state efforts to raise awareness and everything from what the form looks like, what questions are on there, to get people familiar to it. And the last thing I would say around the trust issue is the census is mandated by Title 13 to be solely a statistical piece of information. That data set cannot be shared with any agency or court system. So that's often a misconception. And that is often why people don't account for the number of individuals in their home.
But bottom line, people need to not be afraid to take the census.
Exactly.
They won't be deported. They won't be asked if they're a U.S. citizen.
It doesn't matter if they have warrants out.
It doesn't
this
matter.
This is not connected. Yeah.
Okay. So again, that website is Florida Counts.
FLCounts.
FLCounts. Thank you. And Sabine's organization is part of this coalition of groups seeking a complete and accurate count of the census. Those forms will be going out before we know it, too, right?
Yes, and they're coming in postcards. They're not going to be the traditional form in the first set. So a lot of changes.
Yeah, you make sure you don't lose the form when it comes in the mail. So Sabine Purways, CEO of the Florida Nonprofit Alliance, affiliated with Florida Counts, thank you, and have a great holiday.
Thank you, too.
Thanks for being with us today. Well, that's our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Media in Miami and WLRN Public Media, WJCT in Jacksonville and WLRN in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers. Jason Zabka is Director of Radio Programming. Peter Mertz, Director of Radio Ops, with engineering help from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, Brady Corum, and theme music by Aaron Libos. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks so much for being with us this Friday. We'll be back next Friday at noon. We'll talk to you then.